जिजीविषे क्षतम समः एवं त्वयि नान्यथेतोऽस्ति न कर्म लिप्यते नराय।
One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way, for that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There is no alternative to this way for man.
Okay. So, I took about vegetarianism more or less, and Ishavasya is basically, we discussed what Srila Prabhupada is talking about then, more or less. If there are specific questions, we can discuss, but I covered more or less points. So now, this verse has a rhetorical statement. A rhetorical statement means a statement which, after this, that I want to complete at least one verse per session. All question answers after that. So, we need to complete some things else, please. So, if I say that there is no way to going down this building except the staircase. I mean, there's another way. I can go from the terrace directly down. But what is going to happen is that will be yadgatva anivarana. That will be the end. So there is no practical or feasible way for doing things except this way. So when this verse says that there is no other way except this for man, it means all other ways will cause suffering. If a human being wants to live, if he lives by any other way apart from the Ishavasya principle, that person will get entangled in karmic bondage, and karmic bondage will cause him suffering. So, kurvan eveha karmani. Iha means this, as was described in the previous principle. That was what? Ishavasya. Kurvan eveha karmani jijivishech. Chatam samaha. Jijivishech means to live or to desire to live. Chatam samaha is a long time, 100 years. Nanyathet. So apart from this, there is no other way. Na karma lippate nare. Then if one lives in this way, there is no karmic bondage. Otherwise, there is lots of karmic bondage. So Srila Prabhupada's purport here progresses very beautifully from the principle of karmic bondage to karmic liberation. So first principle that he talks about is how nobody wants to die, but everybody has to die. And that death is because we are attached to our body. And it is karma that causes or the bond between the soul and the body. It is the desire to enjoy which leads to karma that causes the bond between the soul and the body. So karma bandhan causes death. That means, what is the bandhan basically? I may say, I can go to America, I can go to Australia, I can go in a plane, I can go in a ship. Where is the bandhan? The bandhan is in the mind. What do you mean the bandhan is in the mind? That, yes, I may go to America, but if I have cultivated material desires in the past, those material desires will trouble me in America also. I may go to moon also, but the same material desires will trouble me there. The bandhan is the bandhan of asha, of desires. So our bondage is not physical, our bondage is mental. So when this mental bondage becomes very strong in material life, people call it as addiction. You know, a person just can't think of anything else. So most people may not be addicted in the gross sense of the word, but people are mentally bound. People may be mentally bound to cricket, they may be bound to sex, they may be power, or maybe a particular house. Some people feel that, if I go to a new place, I can't sleep over there only. So, this is not a very serious thing, but it's just that people are bound in a particular way. People become uncomfortable when that particular situation is not available for them. That means they are bound to that situation. So, when we say conditioned soul, what it means? The soul who is dependent on so many conditions. This has to work, this has to work, this has to work. Then the soul will be peaceful, then the soul will be happy. So karma bandhan causes death. Because karma bandhan causes us to misidentify with and become attached to the body. And when the body dies, then we also suffer the trauma over there. So this is what Srila Prabhupada talks about in the first purport. And you know, here, there is Kunti Maharani's prayer. It's not quoted over here, but that's very similar. Avidya kam karma bhi. Srila Prabhupada quotes this in Life Comes From Life Conversations. And he says, this is these three words. Avidya kama karma bhi. He says, minimum words, maximum wisdom. He calls it. Why? Because these three words describe the full material existence.
Avidya leads to kaam. And kaam leads to karma.
The full word is bhavesmin klishyamananam avidya kama karma bhi. Shravan smaran arhani karishyan iti kechana. So after describing various reasons why the Lord descends, or rather, what are the various reasons that people think that the Lord descends for? Then she gives the actual ultimate reason. She says, you come to free all people from suffering. And then how the Lord comes to free people from suffering, for that she describes what is the actual cause of suffering. He says, the first cause, the root of all suffering is avidya. We don't know who we are and we don't know how we should actually enjoy life. And because we don't know how to enjoy life, we try to enjoy life through material desires. Avidya leads to kaam. And then kaam leads to karma, karmic bondage. And then that leads to klishyamananam, to suffering. So when Krishna comes, he revives the culture of Shravan Smaran Arhan, worshipping him through Shravan Kirtan, Shravan and Smaran. And that removes avidya. When we remember Krishna, we understand who we are. And we know how to get happiness by remembering him and connecting with him. Then kaam goes away, then karma goes away. And that's how we become free from suffering. So now this karma bandhan is there for all living beings. But only in human life, a person has the ability to become free from karma. And how does that happen? Because one can perform dharma. Only animals act according to instincts. They cannot choose to act according to dharma. They just act according to their nature. So, then Srila Prabhupada talks about how ultimate liberation comes through akarma. And then this is the place where he gives the definition of these three words. Karma, akarma and vikarma. And then after that, he quotes quite a bit from the Bhagavad Gita. So then he goes into the progressive plan in the in the Vedic literature. How they lead ultimately to akarma? Can I have a book? So I'll just highlight some sentences in the purport. So in the middle of the second paragraph on page 24, Prabhupada gives the definition of karma, akarma and vikarma. Actions that are performed in terms of one's prescribed duties, as mentioned in the revealed scriptures, are called karma. So prescribed duties as mentioned in scriptures, that is karma. Of course, if somebody acts according to moral duties also, that is also karma. And this is good karma. Actions that free one from the cycle of birth and death are called akarma. This is bhakti. Prabhupada will explain bhakti later. Prabhupada is not directly using the word bhakti or Bhagavan or Krishna till now in this, because he wants to keep this book in a language that will appeal to impersonalists also. And actions that are performed through the misuse of one's freedom and that direct one to lower life forms are called vikarma. So these are breaking four regulative principles and things like that. So now what Srila Prabhupada is going to do is, in his purport, he says, akarma is the topmost goal. But at the very least, people should give up vikarma and they should come to karma and gradually rise to akarma. Now this is the plan of the Vedic literature. Get people to give up vikarma and move towards karma and then akarma. So then Prabhupada quotes about how Bhagavad Gita talks about the section of karma kanda leading to bhakti 3.9 to 16. So 3.9 to 16 talks about yajñārthāt karmaṇo anyatra. It starts from there and yajñaśiṣṭā, śrīsanta, all those verses. So what they are essentially teaching is that, okay, you want sense gratification, but don't do sense gratification without God. Bring God into it. That means we want artha and kama, but do dharma before that. See, Western culture focuses only on artha and kama. Vedic culture doesn't reject materialism per se. Charvakism is rejected not because it is materialistic, but because it is atheistic. It is non-spiritualistic. So materialism is accommodated within Vedic culture. But materialism is accommodated within the framework of theism. You want sense gratification? Fine. But do religion and get sense gratification. So without dharma, when there is artha and kama, it is never sustainable. Sometimes some civilizations may flourish, but that is all temporary. It will never last. And not only is it not sustainable, that artha and kama never leads to satisfaction. Because when dharma is there, the connection with God is there, then there is some basic foundation, sattva, and there is some santushti. But when dharma is not there, there is only artha and kama, only money and only sense gratification, then one never gets satisfaction. And that's what we see in Western society. We'll discuss about this material, godless materialism later. But then Srila Prabhupada basically, how it is progressing is that, continue. So in the next page, towards the bottom, there's one more sentence I would just like to mark over here. So Prabhupada is very brilliant. See his language, it is filled with gentle sarcasm. So he says, at the bottom of page 25 or page 3 of the purport, an ordinary man works for his own sense enjoyment, and when this principle of sense enjoyment extended to include society, nation or humanity in general, it assumes various attractive names such as altruism, socialism, communism, nationalism and humanitarianism. These isms are certainly very attractive forms of karma bandhana. So these are attractive forms of karma bandhana. This is Prabhupada, that is eloquent vest. It's attractive, but what is it ultimately? It's like golden shackles. You know, they look good, but still they bind because they cause us. But then Prabhupada goes on and, you know, he gives a sort of punch, and then he softens it. Then he says, but there is no harm in becoming a family man or altruist or socialist, provided that one executes activities in relation with Ishavasya, the God-centered conception. So here Prabhupada is talking about include God in your material life. And then if one doesn't do that, then mahato bhayat, one will lose the human form, one will go on a cycle of birth and death. So at the bottom of this, Prabhupada writes, next paragraph, bottom, a humble God-centered life is more valuable than a colossal hoax of a life dedicated to godless altruism or socialism. So earlier he is saying socialism is good, add Krishna in it. But if you don't add Krishna, it is a hoax, it is useless. And then finally Prabhupada brings to akarma, that actually Bhagavad Gita teaches us about akarma. It teaches us about the ultimate goal of life. We'll just look at one particularly puzzling verse in the Bhagavad Gita, which talks about karma. Can you guess which is the verse? No, not that one. No, the next one after that. Karmanya karmaya pashyet, akarmani cha karmaya. One who sees action in action and inaction in action. So it's difficult to pronounce and even more difficult to understand. So this is a verse which is there. So I'll just explain that, because that will also help us to understand the concept of karma. This is 4.18. 4.18. So basically, so now to understand this verse, what it says, one who sees action in inaction and inaction in action. It's a little confusing to understand. So first let's understand words and their meanings. The word karma can have four different meanings. Now I've shown it over there. We use the word and we often mix these meanings in our conversation. And because of the context, we understand what is meant. The word karma can mean any action in general. Or it can mean punya karma. Like we discussed in the three categories, karma, karma, vikarma. Or it can mean the reaction to our karma. Oh, we are all enduring our karma. He's facing his karma. That is the first karmic reaction. And fourth meaning is the whole system of action reaction. Karma is a flawless but inescapable justice. So the word karma has different four meanings. What? Any action can be called karma. Specific punya karma is called as karma. If you look at karma, vikarma and akarma, the reaction to our action is also called as karma, and the system of action reaction is also called as karma. And akarma can refer to many things, two primarily. One is, it can refer to complete inactivity. Literally, if you got Sanskrit translation, it can refer to inactivity. And it can refer to no reaction to activity. So now, keeping these four meanings in mind. Four meanings of karma, two meanings of akarma. Now let us look at this verse. Karmanya akarmaya pashyet akarmani cha karmaya. What does it mean? So, karmanya akarma yah pashyet. So, when we use the word inaction, it becomes a little confusing. So, here I have a simplified translation of this. In this verse, the word akarma means no karmic reaction. And karma means activity. So, what is Krishna saying over there? In activity, there is no karmic reaction. So, in external, physically, the person is active. In external activity. So, here the word karma means what? Any activity in general. The person is doing activity. So, karmanya akarma yah pashyet. That means one who sees that while doing external activity, there is no reaction. So, this Krishna is applying to Arjuna. You are going to fight in the battlefield, but although you are fighting, if you are not selfishly motivated, it will be akarma. There will be no reaction. Karmanya akarma yah pashyet. And then, akarmani cha karma yah. One who sees akarmani cha karma yah. So what does that mean? Akarma here refers to not doing any activity. And karma here refers to karmic reaction. So he's saying that even if you don't do any activity, still you will get karmic reaction. And how does that happen? This is 3.6. Krishna has already told mithyachara sa uchyate karmendriyani sanyamya yasate manasa smaran. Indriyartha vimudatma mityachara sauchyate. So, Arjuna is silently meditating, but if he is contemplating on the sense objects, he is contemplating on how I have to take revenge against Duryodhana and how that rich Duryodhana and that Karana they are enjoying still, and he is seething in anger at them and is desiring to bring about their downfall, his meditation will not lead to any benefit for him. He will get karmic bondage by that. 4.18. 3.6. I have written it over here. Everything is here. Number of words also over here. 3.6. So this is just to titillate you for our Gita course. Whenever it is. So, now basically the point here is that the Vedic culture doesn't make a simplistic division that renunciation is better than action or action is better than renunciation. The important thing is consciousness, is motivation. So when the right motivation is there, action can help, even renunciation can help for some people. But what is important is the changing of the motivation, changing of consciousness. So Srila Prabhupada has a progression in this verse where it takes people from where Prabhupada? Can I have the other mic? So in this purport, Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada basically says, okay, all of us are bound in karmic bondage. So first thing we should do is, don't do vikarma. Then he says is, okay, you can do karma. But then he moves forward and he says, karma is like the 5-star thing, best thing to do. A karma. That is what will give you liberation. This is how Srila Prabhupada is taking us upwards in the progression. And Srila Prabhupada says that we have rendered this in Bhagavad Gita and you can read Bhagavad Gita for further details. So like that, Srila Prabhupada is referring them to a place where this whole thing is given in more detail. So now, even communism, capitalism, even if they are done with the proper motivation, still there can be causes of bondage, as Prabhupada says, because they are all done in forgetfulness of God. They are done in forgetfulness of our spiritual identity, and that's why they are at the material level. And material level is the arena of karma. But if somebody brings God into it, see, the idea of Vedic culture is not to, like yesterday we said, don't demonize the world, but utilize the world. So while utilizing the world, basically how it works, it's like a pyramid. The Brahmana is at the top, but it's not that the Brahmana is meant to enjoy at the top. The Brahmana is supposed to have the least interaction with the world. So it's like If some people may claim that, you know, in Brahmana was given so many privileges in Vedic times. But actually the Brahmana had to follow so many rules also. And the following the rules for somebody who is not Brahmanically oriented could be a torture. So the idea is that everybody has God at the center. But how much can they interact with the world? That freedom is increased as one goes down and down the Varana. So the Brahmanas are supposed to keep themselves very pure. The idea is what? That everybody has to connect themselves with God, but depending on people's nature and inclinations, while keeping themselves connected with God, they can have greater and greater circles for interaction with the material realm. So Brahmanas have to be physically also very pure, they have to take baths so many times, not touch this object, that object, and they have to keep them mentally pure, not get contaminated by material desires. Kshatriyas can have a lot more material desires, and they have much more, in that sense, a control over material nature, but they also have their rules and regulations which they have to follow. They are also accountable. The idea is everybody is encouraged to connect themselves with God. So Prabhupada is using that principle. He said that, okay, communism also you spiritualize it. And we know this famously when the Calcutta Pandal program was there. At that time the Naxalites came and attacked. And not attacked, they threatened to attack. And they gave fly or die threats. And they gave pamphlet fly. So Prabhupada at that time charmed them. What did he say? You people are for communism? Yes. You know, we are also talking about communism, but spiritual communism. And Prabhupada was expert. Like, you know, my message, your language. Like that, you know, he was talking about communism and he charmed their hearts and they allowed the whole program to go on at that time. So, if you look at Naxalites, some of them are very violent. Chanakya Pandit says in Niti Shastra that if a farmer is not utilizing land for growing crops, then he should be taxed 10 times more than a farmer is utilizing land for growing crops. Why? Because that constitutes hoarding. When there is hoarding, then the resources that could be used for people's benefit are not used. And then people's needs are not fulfilled. When people's needs are not fulfilled, then what happens? People become dissatisfied and they become rebellious. So actually, there are many... There are some terrorists who are motivated by religious motives, but many of the Naxalites, they have been poor for so long and they feel the wealthy people are just exploiting a generation after generation after generation, that we have to raise arms to fight against them. Their means are very bad, but their original cause of their discontentment, that was addressed in the Vedic culture by recognizing that nobody has a right to hold resources. If there are natural resources, they should be used for the benefit of society. And if somebody holds resources, that person should be taxed more than others. So that will become like a disincentive for hoarding resources. So that's how in the Vedic culture there was very profound systems for management of even natural resources and taking care of people at a material level. So are there any questions on this? Yeah. We'll take one question, then we'll come to the question which was there from yesterday's session. This, where's the mic? It's here.
Prabhuji, like regarding this Ishavasi principle, like we are now continuing from, like, this is like continuing from first, second and third principle, like, third mantras or like that?
Correct.
And then...
You remember the overview? First verse gives the principle, Ishavasya. Second verse tells, if living in harmony, then like you can live for hundreds of years. What does it mean, live for hundreds of years? That means you can live happily, you will not suffer. You will be happy and you will do good to the world. The next verse will tell us, verse 3, if you don't live this way, you will suffer. Asuryanamati loka, you will suffer terribly. So the same principle going on, the consequences of living in harmony and living in disharmony with that principle.
So question is arising that, that how to apply this Ishavasya principle, like in society, somewhat understanding I got, like, you know, and about like personal life we can understand, but about in ISKCON, in the sense, like in ISKCON means definitely we are understanding we are Krishna in the center, Prabhupada is in the center, you know, like his devotee. And so, what is his teachings are there, we are following or trying to follow. So, how we are trying to apply this Ishavasya, or how can it improve in this case about ISKCON? That question is coming in.
How can we apply Ishavasya more within ISKCON? Well, to some extent, firstly, when somebody becomes a brahmachari, they give up all the positions for Krishna's sake. And grihasthas, they try to give charity for Krishna's sake, whatever they can. And as I said, even in Vedic culture, and as per current Indian law also, even if there is God as the ultimate owner, the king has to act as a caretaker, or the trustees who are there act as a caretaker. So now, as of now, there is a ongoing discussion that maybe the GBC has to be divided into two levels. Sort of a Brahmana GBC and a Kshatriya GBC. Of course, everybody is a Vaishnava and everybody is an advanced Vaishnava, but from the functional point of view. How it has happened is, Srila Prabhupada told us that the GBC is the highest managing authority of ISKCON. That's what he told us. But at the same time, he also said that, you know, that the Brahmanas are the highest. They are the head of the body, social body. And the Brahmanas don't do management. Kshatriyas who do management. So what happens is, when there is management, there is passion involved in it. And that is essential. Prabhupada told us that we want Brahmanas with the Kshatriya spirit. So Prabhupada himself did management, although he regretted, I want to do writing, I'm not able to do. But still he did do management. So of course, Srila Prabhupada was very advanced and he could do Brahmanical work and at the same time do management work also. But maybe over a period of time, the GBC, this is just an ongoing proposal, nothing is final. Right. Within the GBC, maybe there has to be two-tier division, where all the spiritual masters, they will play purely Brahmanical and inspirational roles. They will be maintaining their spiritual purity, and they will play inspirational roles. And then there will be another generation of leaders, maybe the same generation, next generation, another group of leaders, who will take up all the managerial responsibility. But that nothing is decided about that. That is something which will have to be discussed, and then eventually it will be finalized. Because both sides, there has to be the maturity and there has to be some finalization of decisions. So, as I said, you know, we are only in the second generation right now. And many religions took many, many generations to stabilize. But as of now, the principle we can apply is that we can intensify ourselves, our Krishna consciousness more. And overall, it's happening all over ISKCON now. Devotees are taking up their sadhana more seriously. And internalizing of Krishna consciousness, that Krishna was not just about preaching and distributing books and doing rathyatras and building temples. It's also about developing our own hearts. So that is being recognized. So we want to do both. That we have to internalize and we have to externalize also. So at a practical level, Ishavasya application would mean that we make our sadhana strong and we create a culture that recognizes and values sadhana. An individual person may do sadhana, but if the culture recognizes and values sadhana, then that encourages everyone also to do sadhana nicely.
Guruji, connecting this, like some temple is more like doing in youth preaching. So they are they have got something like or skills in that. Some other temple in congregation preaching. Some temple other community, farm community. So coming together and sharing these ideas or sharing this knowledge, that is also considered as Ishavasyam in the sense.
Coming together and sharing the knowledge, is it Ishavasya?
Because
it's desirable, but Srila Prabhupada made ISKCON like a nuclear family. The various ISKCON centers, Prabhupada intentionally made them independent. There was a time when the GBC said that, let us centralize everything. Let us, you know, let all the temple's finances come to the GBC. And the GBC will reallocate the finances according to the projects. And the GBC did this, Prabhupada was so angry, Prabhupada sent a letter to all the temple presidents saying that I have suspended the GBC. Till you get further instruction from me, don't take any instructions from GBC, take instructions only from me. And Prabhupada strongly chastised the GBC, says, this is, your centralization business is not going to work. Don't make a corporation out of ISKCON. He said, the purpose of management is a very beautiful statement. I don't remember the exact statement. Maybe I'll show it later. The purpose of management is to encourage individual initiative. Now we have to encourage devotees. Devotees have the spirit that I want to serve Krishna. The management should encourage devotees to serve Krishna. So it is very good that every temple is individual. So every temple, if there had been centralized finances, then some temples could have become lazy. Now every temple's growth depends only on that temple. And that's why even if something goes wrong in one temple, other temples go on nicely. And that also, you cannot standardize everything, because every leader will have his own personality, his own talents, his own vision. That, of course, that vision is within Prabhupada's broad umbrella's vision. But that's how we will have variety, and that's how we will have individual dynamism, individual energy being encouraged. Now, of course, different temples can surely learn from each other. There was another time when some book distributors were very good at book distribution. They told Srila Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, we have learned some lines. If you speak this, then people take books. So can we go around and share this with everyone? So Prabhupada became very grave. And Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness is individual, voluntary and spontaneous. Krishna consciousness is individual, voluntary and spontaneous. When a soul desires to when a soul is inspired to serve Krishna, then devotional service is performed. Individual, voluntary and spontaneous. What this means is, that what Srila Prabhupada told the devotees is, don't tell them the lines, inspire them to do the book distribution. They will, according to their personality, their nature, according to their relationship with Krishna, their realization, they will speak the lines. So Prabhupada very strongly refused centralization, standardization, homogenization, that sort of thing. Prabhupada wanted individuality. So, that's how there will be variety, there will be dynamism, and there will be growth in multiple directions. So, of course, at another level, like we had Leeds program, where you know different devotees from different temples are coming together and bonding with each other. That is also good. And we can learn from each other. But it is not humanly or practically possible that every temple will specialize in everything. Every temple will have its natural focus. What should not happen is that some temple neglects one thing entirely. Of course, every temple cannot do everything. And some things may be first in the priority, some things may be later in the priority, they may not happen. That is fine. But what does a nuclear family mean? Overall, it's kind of like a joint family, in the sense all of us are one family members. But every center is managerially independent, financially independent. So that way, the leaders have the initiative to grow that temple. Otherwise, bureaucracy will choke everything. And Prabhupada did not want that. There are very beautiful letters of Srila Prabhupada on this point. Clear?
That it is made that every GBC has some area and they are acting in that area. And like others, like in the sense, they can give some inputs or like it's always acts like, you know, only under that GBC only, like that part should some or other, like preaching we should not do in that area, or like
come again, what is the point? I'll search for the next class. Yeah, what is the point?
Like in all our world we can see is dividing GBCs, like, and they are taking care of, like, that is also one management consideration is there. So but sometimes some cases arises. It may happen that that area may be under one GBC, but the preaching is happening, like some spontaneous one devotee is there which is very enthusiastic, and he's maybe coming in that area and he's starting the project. So in that case, like how you know that
okay, see, basically zonal division of ISKCON was something that Srila Prabhupada himself did. Because ISKCON was so big and he wanted devotees to be responsible. So Prabhupada would use the word Guru Datta Desh. Desh means area. Datta means given. Guru is spiritual master. So Guru Datta Desh. This is the area which is given by your spiritual master to you. You go and preach this over here. Prabhu Datta Desh or Guru Datta Desh. That's the word that is used. So in general, the division into zones, that was something that was done so that there could be focus. there could be focus, there could be accountability. And that is fine. Now, after Srila Prabhupada departed, somehow it happened that the zones became too rigid. And you know, one person from one zone cannot go to another zone at all. It became something like that. So, like that, there were something like 13 zones or 14 zones, whatever were there. So, one international society for Krishna consciousness became 14 zonal societies for Krishna consciousness. And that was quite unfortunate. And every zone had its own acharya. And then later on, the devotees found that there was nothing like that. If they read Prabhupada's books clearly, that the zonal acharya means all the people in that area should take initiation from that guru only. That was the system that was there in ISKCON. And then devotees found Prabhupada never intended like that. The zonal division was only for management. You cannot legislate inspiration like that. Who will become the spiritual master? So then later on, the zonal acharya system was rejected. Zonal division and zonal acharya are two different things. Zonal division is a managerial division. It does not legislate faith. It does not determine faith. So zonal division was operational in Prabhupada's times and is operational now. And it is a managerial necessity. Without which there can be no focus and no accountability. But zonal acharya was wrong. Now, as far as one person going and preaching in another area, that is a purely managerial concern. That has to be worked out at a ground level. Now, even if we read the Manu Samhita, we read Chanakya Niti Shastra, there are always, even at that time, there are border disputes. You know, this king has this much border, this king has this much border. How is the border dispute to be resolved? That's something practical has to be worked out. So, this is something which our management is discussing, and they will work out something. See, there is a managerial necessity and there is spiritual inspiration. So there are two different things. So in the name of spiritual inspiration, if we do away with the managerial structure, that will not work. And in the name of managerial necessity, if we deny spiritual inspiration in the role, that will also not work. Is this point clear? Let me say, if somebody is in Pune, but somehow he hears the lectures of some devotee who is preaching in America, and he feels very inspired by that. You cannot tell him, don't be inspired by that person. Isn't it? But then that person who is in America throughout the year, that person is not available practically to guide or support this particular devotee. So then he will have to take guidance from somebody else. So we have to be very clear that we cannot give up one for the other. In the name of being spiritual, we cannot neglect management. That will be complete chaos. You know, if you see that way, it's just a serious example that, you know, there are some policies are how important a policy is. When the five Pandavas got married to Draupadi, they're all brothers, they love each other. What? A sage like Narad Muni comes and tells them, you have to make a proper policy of who will meet her when. And if you don't make this policy, then he tells the story of Shunda and Upashunda, how they fought because of Tilottama and both of them killed each other. So can you imagine the Pandavas killing each other for a woman? It's unimaginable. But that possibility is so much there that Narad Muni comes there and tells them that you have to decide this. And later on after that, when Arjuna, for the sake of duty, violates that code, because he has to protect Brahmana's property, Arjuna insists that I will go to the forest. So, you know, these sort of managerial policy decisions cannot be just dismissed away. They are important. And especially because the Pandavas are Kshatriyas, they are involved and they follow it very strictly. So similarly, you know, we have certain areas where certain guru disciples preach or certain areas where certain temples have authority. If we don't have that, Pandavas are devotees, exalted devotees, and not only they are devotees, they are blood brothers, and still a rigid policy is made. And not only the policy made, the policy is followed. It is followed even when it causes great inconvenience to somebody. So, we cannot just dismiss these sort of rules and regulations saying that they are not important. But at the same time, we have to practically work out how preaching can go on. So, from Pune, there are devotees going to different temple areas where they are preaching. So, normally they take permission from the local authorities and then do something. Some sort of arrangement has to be worked out. So, that's what I'm saying, there has to be balance. One is that we cannot reject managerial necessities. At the same time, we cannot reject the role of spiritual inspiration. So both will have to be balanced in a proper way. And that is something which the leaders will have to decide.
For effective teaching or spiritual inspiration, the person who is doing that, has to involve in management also to a certain extent. He cannot just be a spiritual inspiration and.
Correct. For effective, see, a Brahmana's Brahmanatva cannot benefit the world without Kshatriya's intervention. A Brahmana's Brahmanatva cannot benefit the world without Kshatriya's intervention. The Brahmana is how? You know, he will come and give lectures. Whether one people come, 10 people come, 50 people come, it doesn't matter to him. He will just speak and go away. But a follow-up is not a Brahmana's business. A Brahmana doesn't do like that. No. My point is, let me complete the other point. So, what needs to be done, that's why Prabhupada said we need Brahmana's Kshatriya spirit. That means we have to integrate both the moves. So, we will have to have a proper system. So, somebody who is just playing a Brahminical role, he has to call, like, you know, we have, say, MIHE, VIHE, which are largely Brahminical bodies. They are only doing education. But then the problem comes with MIHE and VIHE, with all due respect to them, is that after the devotees get educated, you know, now they have learned Shastra, after they go back to the temples, do they get a service where they can actually use their learning of Shastra for proper purposes? That they don't have any capacity to do that, because they are only Brahmanic. So then the remaining society has to create that responsibility. But whereas if you look at voice, you know, devotee, we have education and training. I'm not trying to compare in a sense of saying that one is superior and another is lower. And certainly not that because we are voice, so we are superior. I'm just saying that there has to be proper integration. So now VIHE, MIHE are there, then the remaining society has to integrate those Brahmanas and give them proper services. In voice, what happens is, because we have both, so devotees learn Shastra, and after that they have forum where they can use their Shastric knowledge for preaching. So that's how both have to be together. So if there are only Brahmana, some societies focusing only on Brahminical culture, then that society has to be connected with some other body by which that knowledge is utilized. And if there are some people who are doing only Kshatriya work, then, you know, they have to be balanced by the guidance of some Brahmanas. So that means this can work in three ways. One is that some people do both roles, Brahman and Kshatriya. Some people do only Brahmana role, but then they are connected to Kshatriya by which their talents are utilized. And some people do only Kshatriya role, but then they are also connected with Brahmana so that their Kshatriya roles are balanced. So all three are possible. Okay. So now going back from management to philosophy. So Praveen Prabhu had a question yesterday. I spoke yesterday about how the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy was a reconciliation. You know, how Shankaracharya gave Advaitavad gave a wrong interpretation. And the different acharyas have given a correct interpretation. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has, Achintya Bhedavad reconciles the apparent contradiction in the Upanishads. So his question was that, does that mean that the philosophy of Achintya Bhedavad came into existence 500 years ago? And was there no such philosophy before that? And then, is it the authority of the Achintya Bhedavad, is it only based on, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is God and he was such a brilliant scholar? So, it's an important question, and we have to understand one point, that there is the mic. I hope the question is clear, what he was asking. Did I express your question clearly? Yeah. Okay, fine. So, let us understand the difference and the relation between these two terms, philosophy and literature. Once again, the question is that, I explained how in the Upanishads there are various contradictory statements, and Shankaracharya interpreted them in a way that he said most of them are lower, laghu, and a few are mahavakya. But then Ramacharya and ultimately Chaitanya Mahaprabhu reconciled all these statements in their philosophy. So then that means that is the philosophy of Achintya Bhedavad something which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu proposed to reconcile the Upanishads? And is this philosophy not there in the Upanishads at all actually? Is it something which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came up with himself 500 years ago? That's the question. Is the philosophy originally there in the scriptures? Or is the philosophy a reconciliation of the scriptural statements? You have something more to add? There is no direct reference to our doctrine in the scriptures. Okay. So, is there no doctrine? What I specifically said is not that there is no direct reference to our doctrine. I said there is no direct reference to Brahman referring to this aspect of God, Paramatma referring to this aspect of God, and Bhagawan referring to this aspect of God. That is, I mean, going from there to say there is no direct reference to philosophy is a big extrapolation. I don't think that's valid, but your point is important. So let's first understand the similarity and the difference between the two words, philosophy and literature. Sometimes we may say the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, the philosophy of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay? So what does it actually mean? See, philosophy is a branch of knowledge. It is a branch of knowledge that answers the fundamental questions of life. Who am I? Who is God? What is the purpose of life? Why is there suffering in the world? What is the ultimate purpose of life? So there are questions like this. The word philosophy literally means philo and sophos. Philein is to love, sophos is truth. So philosophy means love of truth. So philosophy is a branch of knowledge that answers the fundamental questions of life. And philosophy is just one branch, like we may have another branch, mathematics. Mathematics is a branch of knowledge which expresses the relationship between entities through abstract symbols and numbers. That's a very generic definition. Or you can have botany is a branch of knowledge which studies plants. So philosophy is a branch of knowledge. Now I can say for botany, there are this textbook, there is this textbook, there is this textbook. So we can say that books talk about a branch of knowledge. So, say, there's a Edwin Gray who wrote a book on anatomy. It's a classics text. So there's a book on, there's a literature and there's a branch of knowledge. So certain literatures talk about a branch of knowledge. So can we say that Bhagavad Gita or Bhagavatam, they talk about philosophy? We could talk about it like that. But the point is, that Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, or Chaitanya Charitamrita, or even the Upanishads, they are generally conversations between people. And the conversations map various subjects. The conversations talk about history, the conversations talk about geography, they talk about genealogy. Genealogy means how the vanshaja, how the races go down, who was whose son and whose father was who, like that. They may talk about cosmology, they may talk about politics, and they may also talk about philosophy. So, is the Bhagavad Gita, let's focus on Srimad Bhagavatam now, then I'll come to Bhagavad Gita more specifically. Is the Srimad Bhagavatam a book of philosophy? It talks about philosophy, but it is not only philosophy. There is much more there in it. And even going further, if I want to know what is the philosophy of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is no one place where the philosophy is given. Even if I stick to Srimad Bhagavatam, then I will have to look at all the places where there are philosophical discussions. Say chapter 1.2, there is some philosophy. Then maybe 3.25 to 3.34, Kapil Dev section, there is some philosophy. Then there is, especially the biggest philosophical section, Uddhav Gita, 11.7 to 11.31. So, then in between also there are some places, in some prayers some philosophy may come. So then if I want to understand what is the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam, for example, if I ask a question, why is there evil in this world? Why do good people suffer in the world? Where is there a section in the Bhagavatam which answers this question? One section is there, which is Parikshit Maharaj talking, hearing the talk between the cow and the bull, Dharma and Bhumi. So they are talking, why? Parikshit Maharaj asks, why are you suffering? What is the cause of your suffering? And then Dharma says, oh, some people say this is the cause, some people say this is the cause, some people say this is the cause. So the point which I am making through this is that, if we look at the fundamental question that philosophy asks, one of the questions is, why is there evil? Why is there suffering in this world? So then, it is not that the Bhagavatam has one specific section exclusively devoted to answering this question. that there will be one section which primarily focuses on this, but actually it is not even primarily focusing on this. The focus is how Kali is coming and Kali is attacking, and in that this issue is raised. Now there may be other places also where it might talk about it. Say Yudhishthira Maharaj asks Lord Krishna, why do your devotees suffer? You can say this is also related with the question of why there is suffering in this world. But when a book is a conversation that goes over many subjects, then the issues of philosophy are not compactly dealt with in a topic by topic basis. They are not dealt with in a topic by topic basis. This question, this is the final answer. For that matter, if I ask, what is the conception of God in the Srimad Bhagavatam? What is exactly the Bhagavatam's conception of God? Now, there may be one verse which may give Janmadhyasyata as a definition. The first verse may be a definition. But if I want to talk about the conception of God, then I will have to look at all the personalities who are referred to as avatars, who are referred to as God, and then look at their activities, and then look at whatever is talked about them, and then integrate it all together, and then say, okay, this is the Bhagavatam's understanding of what is God. And then in that progression I can say that the maximum focus that Bhagavatam gives is on Krishna. Therefore, Krishna is the primary or the highest conception of God that is given in the Bhagavatam. Okay? So, I hope these two examples of the problem of evil and the conception of God, these two will make clear the point that the questions that philosophy raises are not answered in a compact, analytical way in the Bhagavatam. The answers will be scattered in different places, and we will have to draw them together and integrate them into one school of, into one coherent narrative, into one coherent explanation. So just as this applies to Srimad Bhagavatam, this applies to the full body of Vedic literature in general. So in the Upanishad, if we ask the question, what exactly is the absolute truth? So it's not that there is one section which answers that question exhaustively. It may answer the question. Chandogya Upanishad, in the particular section, may talk, Shvetaketu and his father, they have a discussion. And there, Shvetaketu is given certain answers by Aruni. But then there are other places where there are other sages who are discussing. So then if I want to know what is the Upanishad's understanding of the absolute truth, I will not get it in one place. I'll have to look at all the 108 Upanishads and then look at all that they are talking about God and then bring it together, and then I will get understanding. This is the Upanishad's understanding of the absolute truth. Okay? It's a lot of hard work. It is not easy. So another way I'll give an example, maybe a more down-to-earth example. Say, instead of having a class, we just have a question-answer session. We just have a question-answer session. There is no class at all. Then naturally the question-answer will go in so many different directions. And then if you are told, can you just tell a summary of the class? You know? It will be very difficult. It will be very difficult. And now what we are asking is just a summary. We are not asking a coherent integration. If you want a coherent integration, it will be even more difficult. Isn't it? So, in one sense, the Vedic literature are like a class. They are like a discussion. And they are primarily motivated by question answers. So, now, of course, the question answers may also have their own flow. And generally, there are not 50 people asking different 50 different questions. There's one person asking question, one person giving answer. So, there are more coherence in it. But still, question answers have the human thoughts and the human emotions are their initiative. It's not the rational, objective discourse that is happening over there. So because of this, when we want to understand the answer to any of the fundamental questions that philosophy raises, who is God? Who am I? What is the ultimate goal of life? Why is there evil in this world? Which is the best path to practice to achieve the ultimate goal of life? We will not find that answer in one place. That answer will be scattered in different places and it will all have to be integrated together. So now, if you look at it another way.
Hare
Krishna. So on this side, if we imagine is, you can visualize as Krishna. So Krishna is giving the Vedic scriptures. Ultimately, we understand the Vedic literature revealed. So whatever books are there is the Upanishads, there are Vedas, there are Puranas, there's Bhagavatam, there's Bhagavad Gita, whatever are there. All these are coming from Krishna. And there are various sages who have spoken it. They are all inspired by Krishna. So Krishna has a complete understanding of the message. Vedaishya sarvair aham eva vedyo vedanta krit veda vid eva chaham. That veda vid. Krishna says, I know all of it. So all the Vedic literature are given by Krishna. So now Krishna also sends his acharyas. So Krishna comes as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then what he does is, there is an underlying unity among all the Vedic literature, which comes from Krishna. But that underlying unity is not easily apparent if I just read the literature themselves, because that knowledge is scattered. So what is scattered, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes and unites it. And then he gives us a holistic understanding. So that holistic understanding, it is not that it is not there in the scriptures, but it is not there in the scriptures in the integrated form that we get it. It is there in the scriptures. It is not that it is something which is, as I said, like Shankaracharya, imported some things. It is not imported, but it is hidden. It is hidden and it is brought together in one framework for us. So, is this point clear? I explained this. So that's why it's not that it is not there. It is there, but it is scattered. And the integrated understanding is given by the acharyas, by like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Supriji, now you're talking about philosophy, that how it addresses the basic fundamental questions. I guess we can include the definition of God and the definition of soul, the physical world and the liberation in philosophy that should be given. So we have the philosophy of Vedas, which is supposed to, Vedas are there. The philosophy of Vedas, which is the integrated of all these things, the underlying thing is supposed to give the definition of this. So is there a work by any of somebody who has done this integration and having the philosophy of Vedas presented to us? And next is our own philosophy, the Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta, philosophy of that. That is the definition of God, soul, liberation and physical world. Does it match with the philosophy of the Vedas?
Okay.
And the other four paramparas, what about the philosophy of them? Does it match exactly? And what is the difference?
Okay. So it's a lifetime answer. But I'll just tell some broad principles. So one of my friends, a very good Gita scholar, Atmanam Prabhu, he's done the similar work for Bhagavad Gita. So I took this as a Brahmachari class in Pune once. What he does is, okay, let us look at Lord Chaitanya's philosophy. Let us look at Shankaracharya's philosophy. Let us look at Ramacharya's philosophy. Then let us look at Bhagavad Gita's philosophy. And then let us look at, basically his thesis was, it was master's thesis on the concept of God in the Bhagavad Gita. So what is the concept of God in Bhagavad Gita? And what is the concept of God in Advaitavad, in Vishishtra Advaitavad, and in Ajinta Vedavad? So I have that book. I can give you later if you want. But it's quite intense reading. It takes a lot of effort. Because, you know, we are not habituated to thinking like this. Because not only do you have to study the verses, but you have to study the Sanskrit first. And look at the multiple translations that can be given and see which is the valid translation. And then compare why this is more valid and why this is less valid. And it's a huge amount of work. It was required in the past ages, but I'll just give a broad example. So, for example, yesterday I made the point in Kanai Krishna's question answer that how Advaitavad imports a lot of things that is not there. So, I'll just give a simple example for this. This is based on his book itself. It's quite exhaustive there, but briefly. See, he takes the concept of Maya. Now, in Advaitavad, Maya is very different. The concept of Maya is very different from what it is in the Chinta Vedavad. According to them, according to us, according to our philosophy, Maya is the energy of God. Maya is the energy of God as a person and he has energies. Maya is one of his energies which creates forgetfulness of God. On the other hand, according to Shankaracharya's Advaitavad, Maya is a simultaneous existent, non-existent substrate of material existent. It's simultaneous existent and non-existent. But most importantly, that Maya creates the concept of God, that Maya creates the concept of the soul, Jiva, and that Maya creates the concept of the world. So his concept of Maya is very different. So Brahman is the only reality, and Maya is the all-enveloping illusion that creates the concept of Jiva, creates the concept of Jagat, creates the concept of Ishwar. So that is his understanding of Maya. So what he does is,
I'll not go again into detail, but just to give a glimpse of
all the hard work that our previous acharyas have done, and all that Srila Prabhupada has saved us from. So, what we can do is, simple is, let us look at all the places where the word Maya comes in Bhagavad Gita. So now we understood what is the Gaudiya Vaishnava understanding of Maya, what is the Advaita Mayavadi understanding of Maya. Now let us look at all the places where the word Maya comes in the Bhagavad Gita and see what the Bhagavad Gita says. Now the word Maya comes only 5 times in the Bhagavad Gita. So now if we look at it, where all does it come? Let's go sequentially. Go to sequentially. First time it comes in? 4.7. Ajopisan avyatma bhutana mishwaro visan prakritim swamadhishtaya sambhavami atma mayaya. So now if you look at the context, what is this talking about? This is talking about avatars. We can go into the intricacies of Sanskrit, I will not go into that. But just broadly it is talking about avatars. And it is clearly talking about, God is saying that I exist, I am Aja, I am Avyaya, I am the Ishwar of all living beings, and I come to this world by Maya, through my Maya. So the Krishna is not saying that my conception is created by Maya. He's saying that I am the Ishwara, I am imperishable, and through some arrangement of my Maya, I come to this world. So what is the connection with the Maya? That is an issue which is, we can leave it at this. But this verse in and of itself doesn't support the idea that the concept of Ishwara is created by my Maya. Because Krishna is saying, I exist beyond the domain of time. I am Aja, I am Avyaya, I am the Ishwara of all living beings. And I come to this world. Okay? Then after that, if we go, 6 or 7. Seven chapters is the maximum reference that come to Maya. 7.14 is Devi Esha Gunmai Mam Maya Duratya Mameva Ye Prapadente Maya Metam Tarantite. So here also you cannot do much. See, Bhagavad Gita Sanskrit is not very difficult. It is simple. What is difficult is the words may have multiple meanings. But overall, the Sanskrit is not very difficult. What does it say over there? If you look at the literal translation, this Maya is divine and it is mine. Say, Mama Maya. It's very clear, it's my Maya. And further, he says, it's very difficult to overcome, but if you surrender it to me, you can overcome it. That means what Krishna is saying is, he is above Maya. He is above Maya, and if you surrender to him, you can go beyond Maya. So this verse clearly refutes the Advaita idea of Maya and clearly supports the Vaishnava understanding of Maya. There's no, Krishna is not saying that I am created by Maya. He's saying that Maya is my energy, or Maya is under my control, and by coming out of, to come out of Maya, you have to surrender to me. So this will support the idea that Maya is Krishna's energy, and it totally rebuts the idea that Krishna, Maya creates the conception of Ishwar. Now if you look at 7.15. It says, Namam Dushkritano Mudha Padnente Naradhama Mayaya Aparita Jnana Asuram Bhavam Ashrita. So now what is Krishna? This is actually irrelevant to our discussion. Because what it is saying is, there are some people who don't surrender to me, and one of the category of people who don't surrender to me is those whose intelligence is stolen by Maya. So all that this verse is Maya deludes some people. But again, this doesn't say that Maya creates the sense of Ishwara, Maya creates the sense of Jiva. It certainly doesn't say that Ishwara is a conception created by Maya. Now if you go to 7.25. Naham prakash sarvasya yoga maya samavrutaha. Mudho yam navya. The verse goes on. What is Krishna saying? He says, I am not revealed to everyone because I am covered by Maya. So now what this is saying is that I am not revealed to everyone because I am covered by Maya. That means I have my existence, but when Maya covers, then I am not seen. It doesn't say again that Maya creates my existence. It again doesn't say. All that it says is that Maya covers Krishna. Now if you go further, you know, what the Vaishnavas tell us, that there is Mahamaya, there is Yoga Maya. Mahamaya covers us, Yoga Maya covers Krishna. So that is different. And this further would substantiate the idea of, again, the Vaishnava understanding of Maya. Not the Mayavadi understanding of Maya. Now if you go further, so these are four verses. The fifth verse is, Ishvara Sarvabhutana Vriddeshe Arjuna Tishtati Brahmayam Sarvabhutani Yantra Rudhani Maya. Yeah. So this is 18.61. And what does this say? It says that all living beings are wandering on a machine made of Maya. Yantra Rudhani Maya. And the Ishvara is residing in their hearts. So now, what does this verse say about Maya? Maya creates the machine for the Jiva. And the Ishvara resides in their hearts. It doesn't again say that Maya creates Ishvara. It only says that, it doesn't even say that Maya creates Jiva. Maya creates the Jiva's sense of self-identity or separateness for Brahman. All that it says is that Maya creates a vehicle for the Jiva to move in this material existence. So therefore, this is all the reference to Maya. Now from these five verses, to come to the idea that Maya creates a sense of Ishvara, to create a sense of Jiva, create a sense of Jagat, create a sense of Jagat, this is, you know, it's like 99% imposition. There's nothing like that in the Bhagavad Gita at all. So just as we did this, so for the concept of Maya. Now, we could go another way and look at the focus, put the focus on the concept of God. And is God under Maya? No, we are focusing on Maya. Is Maya above God? We could go and focus on God itself. Now there are so many verses where Krishna says He is the highest reality. 7.7 says, Mattah parataram na anyat kinchit asti dhananjaya. 10.8 he says, Aham sarvasya prabho. 15.17 he says, Yomam eva asammudo janati purushottama. Sa sarvavid bhajati mam, sarvabhavena bharata. Such a person knows everything, who knows me as a supreme person. So like that if we see, if we want to, there is the facility, it requires a lot of hard work, but we can do that study. And we will find, so this is just, he's very objective in his analysis. And it very clearly shows, that as I said in this discussion, I showed how the concept of Maya in the Bhagavad Gita is not, nowhere near the Advaitic concept of Maya. Like that, now if you go further and analyze the concept of God in the Bhagavad Gita, you will not find practically any support for the idea that the concept of God is a product of illusion. And that there is a Brahman which is above God. That is not there. So through this analysis, we can show. You know, we have the verses in the scripture and we have the devotees who can do the work if it's required. The primary focus is in Kali Yuga, that is not required. Because Kali Yuga, people are not depending about what is the philosophy of the Upanishads. People are debating whether there is any need for philosophy only. What people are debating is, why not just enjoy your senses? So Srila Prabhupada, one of the reasons why he was successful was, he said, he is sensitive to his audience. He said, what is the need of the audience? The audience doesn't even know Upanishad. Their brand of impersonalism is just, I am God, you are God. All of us are God. That brand of Mayavad is a caricature of Shankara's philosophy also. That is not Shankara's philosophy. You know, caricature means complete distortion. So, Prabhupada is just smashing that. So the point is, if we are interested, we can do that studies. And that study will validate the point that actually the Gaudiya understanding of Ishvara, the idea of Maya, the Gaudiya understanding of Jiva, it is the understanding of the scriptures themselves. But this is made available in an integrated form to us by our acharyas, by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Goswamis. if you study the four different paramparas, we'll find that the revelation is moving closer and closer towards the summit that comes in Gaudiya Sampradaya. There are some points, this is a matter of elaborate discussion. And first, to understand this, you know, we'll have to understand first what the four sampradayas' philosophies are. Then we'll have to understand what are the similarities, what are the differences. And more importantly, we have to understand what our philosophy is first. Actually, frankly speaking, you know, in our studies, we just scrap the top of Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy is also so vast. And it's not that it's anything wrong, because ultimately our study is shaped by two purposes. One is our preaching needs and our personal development. Isn't it? These are two needs which shape our study. What we need to preach to others and what we need to convince ourselves. So now, for our preaching needs, very few of us need to study the various six systems of philosophy or the four Vaishnava philosophies and then subtleties. Because that is not the need of society today. And for most of us, we don't need to study all these things to become convinced that Krishna is God and we are His servants and we, by chanting Hare Krishna, will become purified. Because by our practice, pratyaksha vagamam dharmam, we get the experience and we are convinced. But some of us may need it. And those of us who need it, they have to be prepared for the hard work of doing it. And if they are ready to do the hard work, then that avenue is there for doing that. So, to summarize, the point is that we need to shape our study according to what is required for our seva as well as our personal development. And if our personal development requires a deep study of certain things, we can do that. Okay? Yeah, last question. Yeah. Stop with this.
So it seems that the jiva does not have the... I mean, it's not necessary to have the complete understanding of the conception of God. I mean, complete, I mean, totality, the complete understanding of the conception of God, soul, or liberation, physical world, and spiritual world to go back in the world.
Do we need a complete understanding? Well, a complete understanding is impossible. Krishna says, Arjuna says, Swayam eva atmanatmana vittattvam purushottama. My dear Lord, only you know yourself. Nobody else can know you. So, we can never have a complete understanding, even in principle, what to speak of in practice. Even in principle, we cannot get a complete understanding. But what we can and what we should get is a reasonable understanding of the fundamental questions that the world asks us and that our mind brings to us. And we get a reasonable answer and we move forward. It's just like if you study engineering, if you become, say, a nuclear physicist. Even if you are in nuclear physics, you will not study all of nuclear physics. You will study what is required for your job. And as a matter of interest, you may study something more. But even in worldly fields, we don't get complete knowledge of everything. We are finite beings. And actually, scriptural study forces us to become intellectually humble. Why? Because we just understand there is so much to study. So much to study. It brings intellectual humility, and bhakti requires intellectual humility. So, it's just in all material fields also, we don't study any field exhaustively. Nobody can study exhaustively. There's one scholar, you know, it is just a curiosity, somebody sent me a mail, you know, he has done his PhD in the meaning of the word therefore in the last 1000 years of English history. Can you imagine? how the meaning of the word therefore has changed and how different authors have used the word therefore in different senses. So you know, just one word's meaning can become the study of a lifetime for a person. There is just so much to study. So, we are not primarily jnanis, we are bhaktas. We study to develop our love for Krishna. So we want to know Krishna, to love Krishna, and by loving Krishna, we know Krishna. I'll repeat this, is a concluding point, we'll stop with this. We want to know Krishna, not for the sake of knowledge, we want to know Krishna, to love Krishna. And by loving Krishna, we know Krishna. Because Krishna is not an object to be analyzed under a laboratory microscope. Krishna is a person who reveals himself when we offer our love to him. So, this is our basis is, we don't deny the role of knowledge, but knowledge is centered around love. We want to know Krishna so that we can love him, and it is by loving him that we come to know Krishna. Thank you very much. Shri Isho Upanishad ki jai. Shri Prabhupada ki Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Nitai Gaur Premanande. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.